Morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. My name's Marty Bennett, and I'm your host for today's session. And as we go through today's session, we want to be pointing you in the direction of a couple of important resources that SMIE Consulting provides. We'll start first with our SMIE Consulting website. And this resource provides a lot of free information for institutions and organizations that are looking to reach out to prospective international audiences and how we can help. But we also want to say, in reference to resources that we have, there's a lot of great information about the services our company provides. But I also want to point you to in the direction of our SMIE Consulting e-newsletter. It's a free subscription to that available. I've dropped the link in the Facebook comments section so that you can find this week's edition, and then hit the subscribe button to add your name to the list. That's where we bring to you each week from that newsletter that comes out Mondays. We bring three of those news stories or more to light here at the Midweek Roundup for a little bit more in-depth discussion. So we're glad that you're here with me now, so that we can talk through some of these key issues that are affecting our industry today. The three that we'll be talking about first are China and academic freedom, and some interesting cases around the world related to that. We'll look also at post-study work opportunities in Australia and whether or not they're working with the desired effect. And then we'll look at some reactions from an article in the Inside Higher Ed publication on reflections from international educators, or from admissions personnel on both sides of the desk, from the college admissions side as well as the guidance counselor side, on their reactions to what happened at the NACAC annual conference in Louisville a couple weeks ago. So we'll talk about that and more in the next half hour, and we're glad you've been able to join us today. Good to see some folks jumping on the roundup that are new, and also some veterans there that have been on many times before. So we're going to start first with China, and we're going to look at an article that actually came out in Forbes. Forbes says, obviously, well-respected business journal around the world, but they obviously, like many other businesses these days, have operations in China. And they've had their director, or their, I should say, the he is a columnist for Forbes China, is Robert Daugherty. And Robert is executive dean of Forbes School of Business and Technology and a columnist for Forbes China, as I mentioned, the Chinese language edition of Forbes. And he is also a former Fulbright scholar. And he's been writing, actually gave some remarks to a conference in China about the recent trade tensions, I guess, is the way he phrases it. He's obviously coming at it from an education perspective, but also from a business perspective. And he makes the point, and it's a very strong defense of why U.S. and Chinese relationships should continue in education. And regardless of the business ties, just the incredible wealth of information that we have about Chinese students that are studying here in the United States and their contributions to our campuses, but also economically to our country. He speaks to the disparity of Chinese students studying here versus the relatively paltry 12,000 U.S. Students that are studying in China. There are a lot of reasons for that, but even China's current president, who was a student at one point. He's at Tsinghua University. He did come to the state of Iowa for study at some point. But Mr. Daugherty, during his remarks, commented on the current trade tensions and looked at a few things that spoke to the cooperation that has existed and can still exist between the U.S. and China, and how educators tend to rise above in general terms, rise above any political disagreements that might exist between nation states. And while that may be true, certainly I think Mr. Daugherty's certainly looking through and making these remarks through some rose tinted glasses, I would think about the overall relationship between China and the US, which I think is an overall positive one. There's still some realities on the ground that are making the case for a more cautious approach, and certainly one that we should all as educators should all be paying some close attention to. The next related article to this, and so that's talking about academic freedom. Professor Doherty's thought on academic freedom from keeping it open and connections between our two countries on the education front open as much as possible. And that's more, it seems to be more on what how much we're keeping open as opposed to what China is allowing to be open. And a related point to that comes from a recent Chronicle of Higher Ed story that talks about the confluence, and this is by not the confluence, but the conflict between China's ambitions to become a world-class educational provider with that contrast with their tightening grip on what we consider academic freedom in the West. Now, there are certainly a lot of people who, when they hear about these connections between China and the U.S. Economically and from the higher ed side, the thought is from many outside of education that that China is it's a communist state. It's got tight control over everything. It's an organized and planned economy with a market-driven economy. Elements of a market-driven economy certainly folded into it. But the reality is that for most people outside of education is that they are very restrictive when it comes to freedom of expression. Most people reference Tiananmen Square, and that seems to be the end of it in terms of where how far that's all you need to say to say, well, maybe you're right. But there are those within higher ed that have had productive relationships between institutions in China and the United States that would say something a bit different. Let's say yes, there are certainly challenges in either setting up a U.S. campus in China. There's very few U.S. institutions that have done that well. Very few that are outside the U.S., are more outside the U.S. than inside the U.S. that have actually successfully done that. But where they have done it, there's always the underlying currents of, well, do our Chinese hosts, where we're either through a partner institution or through, in fact, the Chinese government, are they respecting academic freedom and human rights in general when it comes to higher education and freedom of expression? So there's been a lot in the past month with now the 70th anniversary of the Communist Party control in China. There's been cycles of engagement and openness, and Karen Fisher's article certainly explains that and gives that backstory on a lot of what's been happening. And the thoughts are, particularly from the Scholars at Risk, Scholar at Risk Network, produced through IIE. Certainly, there's a good number of evidence to suggest that there are some real challenges to true academic freedom with U.S. institutions in China. We've also had, and we've chronicled those here on the Midweek Roundup over the last year or so, the challenges with the Confucius Institutes, another example of Chinese government's extension of soft power around the world. Through setting up these institutes on primarily university campuses to project perhaps their custom image of what Chinese culture, what Chinese language, and Chinese politics in a lot of respects is like. So there's been challenges there. There's also been recent developments in the U.S. and abroad, other countries related to the Hong Kong protests, where the democratic forces in Hong Kong have been protesting against what they see as very undemocratic policies that the Hong Kong regional government has put in place that they feel are directed by by the national government in China, in Beijing. So there's some real issues there, and we'll get to one of those in a moment. But it'll be interesting to see this constant story. And I know we've seen some recent articles by certainly our colleagues at INTED have actually posed that we need to continue to be engaged with China, and not let the simple fact that they are not completely free operationally for U.S. operations in China for academic freedom to really thrive. There's been comparisons to what's happened with a recent protest in Singapore about academic freedom from a Western perspective versus how it's viewed in East Asian culture. So there's some challenges there, but they really are the challenges that we need to be, I think, rightly so, need to maintain our engagement with China. And it's better to engage than to completely disengage and lose all real access to what is one of the most important markets in the world for the U.S. economy, for U.S. education and institutions. So the last piece of this China academic freedom story comes from, actually comes out of Canada at McMaster's University in Ontario. This is related to what we were talking about, you know, with Chinese student associations in the United States have been kind of towing the party line in terms of what the national government in Beijing would want, in terms of how the protests are being viewed in Hong Kong by Western nations and by there have certainly been speakers that have been challenged openly by Chinese student associations in the United States when they've come on campus in support of the pro Hong Kong demonstrations. Here we see with this story in Ontario at McMaster University, we see the chapter that the Chinese Student Association there has actually now lost their status at McMaster University because of protests that they initiated against a Uyghur activist talk that was actually allegedly, according to the university officials, coordinated with the Chinese consulate. And this certainly doesn't have the ring of untruth, because we've seen examples in the U.S. of where the Chinese consulate has, in their support of Chinese student associations on campus, particularly related to Hong Kong and other issues, have gotten involved or supported association efforts that were contrary to what we in the West consider academic freedom issues of the freedom of speech for all viewpoints to be discussed openly. And this, for those not familiar, the Uyghurs are ethnic minority, religious minority in northwest China in Xinjiang province, and mainly Muslims that have been in the equivalent of what we in the West would call concentration camps for reconditioning or retraining so that they would become less threatening to the national government in terms of their activism and with their religion. And that's certainly something in the West we certainly do not endorse by any stretch. And so this talk was disrupted in Canada, so it's happening north of the border too. So it'll be interesting to follow this story as it develops, and I know there'll be more to come on that. So enough of China. We talk about it quite a bit here on the Midweek Roundup, but we want to do switch gears and go to Australia, go down under, and talk about their temporary graduate work visa, their post-study work visa, the 485 visa, they call it, that was introduced in 2008 and updated again in 2013, where it allows international students studying in Australia the ability to engage in post-study work for 2 years under this visa, temporary graduate visa. Their numbers who are on that visa have increased to nearly 92,000 temporary graduate visa holders in Australia. That's up from 71,000 a year earlier. And has been seen by many in the industry as one of the most attractive features to Australia education for why an international student would want to study in Australia. Obviously an English medium country, but a country that has recognized and has, since the late 80s, mid to late 80s, has really recognized the importance of higher education as economic development tool for the country, not only for their campuses and the universities where they enroll, but also industries in Australia that have become increasingly dependent on international students and that are coming for vocational education, but also higher education studies. So that's been an important piece of the attraction of Australia over the last couple decades. Now, what's interesting that this this article relates is that these changes, or these certainly the increases that have been seen for these 485 visa holders in Australia, they have their top five countries for those that are actually transitioned from student to this temporary graduate work visa are India, China, Nepal, Pakistan, and Vietnam, their top five. They are also the top five countries for students in master's degree programs since 2013. Those have been their top three countries. So the numbers of students that hold those 485 visas has actually increased, and not unlike the United States, where Indian students have dominated the OPT and STEM OPT numbers here, as well as H-1B work visas in, here in the United States. In Australia, the Indians are far and away, certainly have been since 2017, the largest group of 485 visa holders. But you do see actually Chinese students had been the number one from 2013 to 2016-17, and then before that it was India. So we've seen those two countries, obviously, for a lot of different reasons, are the number one and two in different orders in different countries, but in terms of student populations, but also in terms of those that are most looking to work. In the U.S., overwhelmingly it's Indian, and then to a much lesser degree, China and other countries. So the challenge has been a survey follow-up to those folks that the numbers when these 485 visa holders were recently surveyed, up to 56% of current visa holders either worked outside their field of study, 35%, or were unemployed. So that's over half, 56%, again, that are. If they were in the United States, they would that visa status would no longer exist. They would be asked to leave the country or change to a different status or go back to school, whatever it might be. So the challenge really is for these international students in Australia is where are they actually getting jobs that they train for through their degree studies, and apparently the answers are the majority are not. They might have been looking for it, but they're not getting those jobs. So the question is that this is the answers in terms of satisfaction. Even though there was an overall satisfaction rate of 66%, the ones that were dissatisfied with their visa experience, this 485 visa experience, were because the two-year time limit was too short to gain the confidence of an employer that might want to keep them on a more longer-term permanent residency type visa, that employers were preferring those that already had permanent residency and really didn't understand the 485 visa, that there was lack of flexibility in extending the 485 or renewing it. There's a lack of support from related stakeholders, that would be institutional career services folks, and lack of advice on pathways for these graduates. So it's interesting to see this happening in Australia, where the work opportunity is a big magnet for students that want to go there, one of the big magnets, but it's also become potentially the picture's not as rosy on the back end for international students that want to study there. So there's challenges no matter what country you go to when it comes to post-study work. And certainly Australia is not immune to it. And we've seen challenges in the U.S., certainly with delays with OPT processing lately. We've seen that with H-1B, threats to changes, dramatic changes there. But we see other things that, like in the U.K., their post-study work opportunity was eliminated for a period of 7 years, is now being reintroduced, and how that impacts interest. So really, it's a matter for that. I think a lot of folks in the industry keep an eye on, particularly when it comes to macro changes in major destination markets, and whether or not they'll still be as attractive to prospective students. Now, we'll finish today with a kind of reflection on what's happened at the NACAC conference in Louisville earlier this month. We saw, end of September, beginning of October, we saw the big news of that week was certainly the vote for a certain code of ethics and professional practices that have been a part of NACAC's kind of standard operating procedures for code of conduct for its members, that was prompted by threat of lawsuit from the federal government that in NACAC's eyes would have been financially crippling to their organization and would have left their members vulnerable to additional legal challenges. And so what has happened ability of institutions to offer early decision incentives, recruit first-year undergraduates and recruit transfer students, that those restrictions were lifted that allow universities and colleges to extend their recruitment of students beyond the May 1st deadline, after which most particularly freshman students have had to deposit at institutions. We know for many years that parents and students have been double depositing and paying the $100 or $200 or $300, whatever it might be, that's non-refundable and taking that chance and just pushing and maybe asking for more aid, whatever it might be, for years. So that piece has already been happening on the student side that allows them to keep their options open from the student side. But now the reason the Justice Department requested that NACAC make these changes is to because it was seen as a restriction on trade, as of antitrust investigation that the Department of Defense or Department of Justice was conducting. So it's interesting that that has finally happened, and seem to be like the article is in Inside Higher Ed is called End of Admissions Era, a look at last week's NACAC National Conference as expressed through the stages of grief. So yeah, for those that are familiar, anger and depression and bargaining and acceptance and denial are certainly those initial stages of grief, or the main stages of grief. A lot of the article centers around the CEPP restrictions being lifted. But we also, there was reference to the keynote speaker, Randy Zuckerberg, who's the sister of Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, and her comments and speech kind of went off like a balloon, and that's considered to be tone deaf as it relates to her audience. And this is certainly something that in the wake of Varsity Blues and the scandal that's already been a major focus of college admissions counseling for the last year. This has been kind of where it all kind of came to a head. These kind of conversations that were happening over email were happening face to face for the first time, and there's a lot of unburdening of souls as it relates to these kind of issues, and it's sad to see for an industry that. That's where my professional career started, in domestic admissions. But in the midst of it, there's really a challenge for what the future means, whether it's the CEPP restrictions being lifted or whether it's more tangible threats that that institutions see to their ongoing success as institutions, the ability for private liberal arts colleges that are in the Northeast that are, and throughout the Midwest and other parts of the country that are not well known, and their financial viability long term. There's those kind of conversations that are happening. So there's a lot going on in higher ed that really makes a very challenging time to be a part of the industry. And certainly on the international side, institutions are not immune from disruption and threats to their existence. So it's going to be very interesting to see where these conversations go in the coming weeks and months. But we'll certainly be keeping abreast of those here at the Midweek Roundup. I want to encourage all of you who haven't already checked out the podcast. We do, for those of you who'd rather see or listen to the listen to what we have to say rather than watch us each week, you certainly can do that through a podcast called the Midweek Roundup, available on all major podcast providers from iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and Podbean. You can find us all on any of those platforms. But you can also, if you like to catch some of the episodes that we've run every Wednesday at 1 p.m., you can find that here on the Facebook page, or our YouTube channel has a playlist of all the editions going back to July of 2018. So we thank you for your time today. Look forward to connecting with you in the future, and have a good rest of your week. Cheers.